6.5% was it? Is that what the current odds are of the Stanley Cup?
Well, and if you look at the round by round progression, the Stanley Cup favorite is the Vancouver Canucks.
Like, what a time to be alive!
Talking you through every goalie controversy, scoring slump, and draft lottery bust, this is the C4 Podcast on CanucksHockeyBlog.com. Here they are, the best starting lineup we could afford under the salary cap. Chris, Matt, Anna, and Adam.
Welcome to another episode of the C4 Canucks Hockey Podcast, brought to you by CanucksHockeyBlog.com on the Full Press Coverage Network. I am Chris at Lightforce, joined virtually by the much more healthier than I am, Anna Forsyth at A4Size03. Welcome, Anna.
Thanks, Chris. It's not the best compliment you've given me in the intro, but I will take it because I'm happy to be healthy and I'm sorry that you aren't.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that I am not healthy. I am currently, I don't know, am I in protocol or not? Like, we don't have testing like the Vancouver Canucks do, but things were getting pretty sketch that I missed a phone call that I think came from the Raj. They may have expected me to back up, was it DiPietro a couple nights back? I mean, right now, the way the Vancouver Canucks goaltending situation, that could be Chris Levesque for all I know.
Yeah, I think you should start driving to Abbotsford now, just in case.
Okay. I mean, I heaven forbid who they actually have playing for Abby, but I am here. I'm sucking it up for the show. And as I alluded to last show, we wanted to line up a special guest. Now, it wasn't the guest that I've been trying to get, because I need him to come and tell me that the rumors of him double-dipping trips is either true or untrue. That's Thomas Drantz. But I got a better guest than Mr. Drantz. We have Yerky joining us. You might know him as Yerky21 on Twitter. Also, the author of Benning on Empty, which is by far the only thing that got me through the past, what felt like 100 years of the Benning regime. But all the way from Ottawa, welcome.
Thank you. I'm sorry for not being Thomas Drantz. That's probably a bit more of an exciting get.
No, I mean, so I felt
Thomas
like
before.
Of,
we haven't had you.
Yeah, I mean, and I kind of had to address the fact that last show I said, yeah, we're going to try to get Drantz on. Haven't been able to work things out. And I obviously, with Benning on Empty now in book form, felt that we needed to line you up. Because I understand you're doing the Canucks podcast circuit right now. We're probably like, what, number 5 out of 138?
I appreciate the compliment. It's 2 of 2, but okay. It's, you know, it's a start. Anyone else wants to have me, here's the official announcement. I'm open for business.
Okay.
Awesome. But thanks for joining us. We'll obviously get into to the Benning era, Benning on Empty as a comic and all that jazz. But the Vancouver Canucks have had a week. Our podcast single-handedly cursed the Vancouver Canucks, or at least Anna did. So we'll get into how Anna cursed the Canucks goaltenders, at least. There is some front office action in Vancouver. And I don't know, you know, this podcast as we are, we're going to get into all sorts of different things. So let's stop wasting your time and start rewinding. Before we get into the Vancouver Canucks sort of week that was and what they've been up to, let's talk a little bit about the Benning era, the 100 years that was Vancouver Canucks history.
100 years.
It was 100 years, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Felt like it.
So, I mean, we were talking before we clicked record as to when we're the longest running Canucks podcast, having got a couple of months on Pucks on Net. Podcast wars are legitimately a thing. And at some point in time, we'll have a street fight to determine who is the ruler. But I think all of us really got into the swing of things, the long-term ones, sort of the last year of Gillis. So we've podcasted through the Benning era, which was supposed to bring sunshine and rainbows and a rebirth of a franchise. And I don't know how that really happened, did it?
Now you got to dig deep to think now. Yeah, no, I'm thinking it didn't. I'm thinking it probably did the opposite of that. Yeah.
I mean, they're only a couple years away, right? I mean, just 2 more years.
And 2 more
the
Canucks, years.
The Canucks would have been there, right? I mean, yes, 2 years was like 5 years ago, but in 2 years.
I do wonder, Yaki, like how long into the Benning era did you think, A, it's not going to work out, and 2, I could do something with this?
So I don't know if it's a point of pride or if it makes me sound really reactionary to say that I disliked Benning pretty much instantaneously. His very first moves on the job were all quite bad. I didn't like the Kessler trade. I didn't like when he dumped Garrison, even though it now sounds like small potatoes in hindsight. I didn't like the drafting of Jake Virtanen. I certainly didn't like the signing of Ryan Miller. And it just seemed to be setting course in a way that a franchise that was clearly in need of taking a bit of a step back and rebuilding was not going to do. And I know I'm not making this sound cutting edge. Like, that was a pretty common sentiment, I think, among those who had either a bit more of a progressive outlook or at least wanted to see some sort of top-down plan as to how this was going to go. It had been a long time since the Canucks were really in the dregs and, you know, really having to build from scratch. And I think a lot of the fans weren't really ready for that possibility. But some of us, we had long enough memories to know that not only did it need to be done, but it would actually turn out a lot better, right? We saw that with the Keenan era too, which people talk about like the worst time ever. And it wasn't fun while it was on, but it wasn't that long. And it laid the groundwork for the most successful period in team history. So it's not a tough pill to swallow. And when the earliest signs were that they weren't doing that, I was skeptical right away. That said, the team bounced back a little bit. They were a playoff team, not a particularly strong one, but they made it. And so for most of that season, there was a wait and see approach, even though I and many others didn't like a lot of what was coming out of Benning's mouth, like both content and style. He didn't inspire a lot of confidence. Anyone who saw that video of him in the Boston Bruins war room about when they wanted to trade Tyler Seguin, like there's no way to sugarcoat it. He came off like an idiot. And it just, between ownership chasing the Boston model and then making these moves, there was a lot of reason for trepidation. And things were going okay. And then they did that double-barreled signing of Dorsett and Spiess on the same day, which, mm-hmm. you know, that immediately you started to take away whatever benefit of the doubt you might have granted. The playoffs came and went, and they didn't take a very enlightened approach to everything about, you know, their moves leading up to the playoffs, the playoffs themselves, this postseason right after that, where they started moving pieces around. They got rid of Bonino, who they just gone. They brought in Sutter. They signed him to some ridiculous contract, and more it seemed like they did not have a clue what they were doing. Everything went down the toilet the following season. It went exactly as it seemed that it might for a group that didn't seem to know what they were doing. And given how quick on the trigger ownership had been, not just with Mike Gillis, but also with Dave Nonis before him, mm-hmm. you wouldn't expect this was going to last very long, right? That they wouldn't have a long tolerance for being not only a bad team, but like a team that was sort of bad in every way, right? They couldn't really point to the future. They weren't otherwise exciting or young. Like they just didn't have a lot going for them. And so you figured this isn't going to last maybe one more year, right? Maybe they'll see out the Desjardins contract and that'll be that. I started making the comic about 2/3 of the way into that second season, thinking it was almost kicking, I was going to mix metaphors and say kicking a dead horse, but that things were already in motion for this to not really be a lasting period, and that it was just kind of funny to laugh at in a more transitory sort of way. And so I had thought about doing something like that for some time. So I put together a comic. I used to do this kind of thing for fun. I used to post images on the crack.com website, if you know it. Even when I was a kid, I used to draw comic strips and stuff. So this was old hat. And I just wanted to kind of make fun of the administration for others who were of like mind. I posted it. And I didn't use Twitter much back then, but I did post it to Twitter and I tagged a few sports writers, including Jason Botchford. He quote tweeted it with the word wow, and quite a lot of people reacted. And so that egged me on. And so I started doing them as best I could every week after that. Mm-hmm. Didn't always do it. Before we knew it, the offseason came and went and they were doubling down. And you know, the team was moving backward, if anything. There didn't seem to be an end in sight, but once more, you kind of figured the 3-year point would be where everything would probably change. And when it didn't, yet again, that's where it started getting scary. Desjardins was gone. They were giving him a second coach. There was, again, no real sign of progress, right? They'd always, people who supported the regime would point to, oh, there's these young guys, there's these draft picks, exactly like every other team. That's how the system works. And you could see the tide was really beginning to turn in the fan base, I think. You know, to the extent I was an early adopter of being skeptical, I don't think I was anymore by the third year. Even by the second, honestly, the 2016 offseason was one for the ages in terms of just a conglomeration of terrible moves. And so, the more people got frustrated, the more my comic started getting traction. And so I tried to do it as best as I could. At first, I thought it was just kind of funny and for the amusement of people online. It was only really in 2018 when Jason Botchford went on the Halford and Bruff show and talked about people around the league reading it, that I sort of took a step back and I said, wait, are people in the game actually reading this? And Botchford later went on Real Good Show as well, and he kind of explained his comments in a bit more depth. And it turned out, yes, that apparently it was circulating quite a bit. He was getting asked about it. He was getting asked who I was as well, which amused me to no end. And I started playing into that a little bit in the comic as well. During this time, as the era dragged on, we were talking a bit about this before. It was actually an era of great creativity in the Canucks fan base. And, I'm happy to have been part of that, but I was by no means the only one. And whether it's the proliferation of podcasts or the memeing or any number of parodies in whatever medium they came out, the Canuck fan base honestly found their voice. And knowing that stuff actually does get around, which is kind of one of the marvels of the internet age, it actually, I don't want to overstate it, but it kind of felt like it meant something a little bit more at that point, right? And that really culminated in the end of the Benning era, where the anger was really palpable, and you got the sarcastic signs and the jersey throwing and all that. But there's something kind of reinvigorating about knowing that fans can make a difference, and the league sets up a monopoly in this market so that the owner can do whatever he wants, and as long as enough people buy tickets, he doesn't really ever have to respond. And it's nice to know that there is actually an outlet to be able to push back a little bit. And by God, it was needed, and much earlier than it happened. But at the end of the day, I think everybody can see how much better and more hopeful things are now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, honestly, when you kind of put an inventory on it like that, it's kind of frightening how many times he could have and should have been fired over those times.
It was unprecedented, right? Sports owners are not a patient bunch.
No.
And generally speaking, there's a short timeline on these things, because I would dare say that the folks in the industry themselves don't really understand how a zero-sum league works, namely half the teams have to be below average at any point. And so they often, change happens more often than not. And it is astonishing that it did not happen in this case with, a reportedly hot-headed ownership group. There's theories, left and right about why it is. And my personal one is that I think he and Benning were just kind of friends. I think he didn't want to fire his buddy who did what he wanted. Even Francesco Aquilini must look back at this now and be like, oh yeah, I didn't have to put everyone through 8 years of hardship, right? I could have actually made things better a lot earlier than I did. And it's incredible.
Yeah. The thing that you sort of mentioned was how, when we talk about sort of dark eras, the Keenan era, I'm an older fan. I mean, as there are many of us out there, not as many as I think there once was, but again, we remember the Keenan era. And it wasn't until I think last year when I started actually doing the math, and for what we as Canucks fans look at the Keenan era as a real dark period of time, it was a dark period of time in a short time frame.
Very short.
Like a season and a half, 2 seasons, really. I think people cloud the issue when they think, well, Messier was longer. Well, yeah, but that Keenan era was where the darkness occurred. And then, change, in comes Brian Burke. And then from there, you're right. Some of the most successful Vancouver Canucks teams we've ever seen happened in that period of time through to really the 2011-2012 seasons, I guess.
Directly attributable to it too, right? I'm not supporting the way Keenan went about it, and it was very acrimonious and it was not enjoyable as a fan, but it was mercifully short, right? Keenan was around for parts of 2 seasons, Messier for 3. By the third one, everyone already knew a rebuild was on, so you can't even compare, right? And anyone who makes it sound like that era was worse, they can't do basic math. It's as simple as that.
And that's the thing is, I'll admit, because I was so scarred by those dark years, that I kept, is it really that bad? And it wasn't until really last year when suddenly I'm actually putting together graphics. And here at C4 and really Canucks Hockey Blog, math has never been our strong suit. So I start doing these graphics where I'm actually going through essentially how many seasons did this general manager have and what was their playoff performance. And aside from getting a lockout year missed on Nonis and punishing him for it, the thing about it was that Benning was in a class of his own. Mm-hmm. Like no general manager who had a tenure greater than 4 years had a below 50% playoff. Like their teams made the playoffs more than one out of two times. And that just blew my mind. And I'm now starting to think like, what the heck is going on here? Cause you also pointed out NHL owners are not patient. I mean, sports franchises, they're owned by impatient people,
mm-hmm.
but when we look at the Vancouver Canucks, I don't know if there's a team out there that builds its entire financial future on we need playoff games. Like they need the playoff revenue. We need the gate. We need to make the money. And here's a guy running a team who's not getting you that extra cash you want to go and build your franchise yeah. around.
Not only did they set the wrong goal, but they didn't accomplish it. And that alone should have been cause for change. It's very baffling. It's an interesting case study, honestly. It's a cliche, but to be a fly on the wall in some of those meetings, like I'm sure there was a lot of internal discord within the family. The rumors were that the other brothers were keener on moving on and Francesco wasn't, which is again why I sort of think it was maybe personal. And that there was really a lot of his own friendship invested in that. But, in my book, which is more than just the strips themselves, I have an introductory section where I talk about some of the things we were discussing now, kind of what launched the comic. But I also have an epilogue section at the end where I just very briefly make that case that this was the darkest era in team history. And one of the things that you were touching on a bit there has to do with, it's hard to compare across eras, right? Because the criteria were very different, but that all played into Benning's advantage, right? He and Gillis are really the only two GMs, well, I guess known as two, were the three GMs that were in the cap framework where there's mm-hmm. enforced parity. There's a salary cap, which causes free agents to rotate all the time. It is so much, it's harder to be really, really good now, but it's also harder to be really, really bad. And once you take that into consideration and people start comparing this era, for example, well, the 1970s were worse. Well, yeah, the 1970s, the Canucks were an expansion team in a small market. There was nothing like we have today in terms of the volume of information at the team's fingertips, right? Like now, if you don't want to, you don't have to be bad at scouting. There are tons of free resources out there that can make it a completely no-brain affair that will at least make you average. They didn't have that back then. You relied on whichever human you sent to Sweden to watch three games and report back and who should pick. So it was so much more of a wild card situation. There was no guarantee that you were going to improve, and the Canucks generally didn't. And they also had a couple powerhouses in their division that ensured that they couldn't. Benning was dealing with none of that. He had all this free information at his fingertips. He had a cap system, a reliable draft network, whatever you want to call it, that at the very least could have just pushed him to parity if he did absolutely nothing. And instead, he did the opposite of nothing. He did things that actively made the team worse and that harmed their future chances. And for that, to me, that is a lot worse than being like a ne'er-do-well in a 70s and 80s environment where it was a bit of a, there was only so far a team in Vancouver could go. And this was a waste of potential like we've never seen, right? Vancouver only became a big market team or an important franchise when the Macaws came in. And you really have to compare them with that. And again, once you bring in the cap, it's a whole new ball game. And it's actually, I'm still incredulous that just they didn't accidentally do better than they did.
Yeah, I think you're right that, like, it's kind of crazy to me. You hit the nail on the head when you said the era of enforced parity, and yet Jim Benning made it seem like Vancouver was in this special situation where it made mm-hmm. it harder to be a GM than any other team in the league. Mm-hmm. Whether it was the pandemic or the cap era or players or, the fan market. But I think that's one of the really damaging myths that the Benning era has kind of propagated. One, it came out of the sort of need for toughness, but like, which I've kind of hopped on about way too much, but also the idea that Vancouver's this toxic fan base when, you know, so much of that came from how poorly the team was run. And I think that myth is still kind of out there.
Yeah, I would say, I made the point online a few times. I think any franchise in any sport in this situation, you would get a pretty similar response to being kind of force-fed bad management when, let's face it, the fan base knew better, right? We're not stupid.
Yeah.
And there are so many precedents out there to compare to, right? Like they were the ones doing things the weird way, not the folks who wanted to rebuild or, you know, who thought X or Y trade was bad. That was my most popular tweet, is that I said, you know, people would analyze what he's doing saying, well, on the evidence, that's dumb. And we'd be told, well, wait and see. And then it would prove to be dumb. We were told, well, that's hindsight.
Yeah.
That was not true. That's foresight. And you know, like, I mean, Anna, you'll know the way things are across the pond. Fans don't pull their punches. They don't say, well, you know, we have to be patient. It's not fair. These guys have families, right? Like this idea that Vancouver is unique. The only thing Vancouver is slightly more than other markets is online, right? Like the Pacific Northwest is, at least anecdotally, is very connected, like early adopters for the internet. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Twitter base in the Vancouver fan base is actually a larger proportion of the fans than maybe some of the other teams. But I don't think it's any more toxic than anyone else. Like, these people ever looked at political Twitter?
Yeah. I think the only thing that's unique, as you say, is like, yeah, Canucks Twitter may be more active. And it's the idea of a small city, like it's big enough that it's a city, but there's only a million people that live in the city itself. And like, they have one team to care about.
Yeah.
Like, the BC Lions is terrible. The Whitecaps are terrible. Like, so it's kind of focused maybe more than some other cities, but yeah. I mean,
I'm out here in Ottawa. I can compare, and no doubt there's a difference, but there's a lot of historical reasons for that, right? This is a government town. A lot of people like me come from elsewhere. A lot of the people who lived here above a certain age don't cheer for the Senators because they were set. So it's a more chill atmosphere in the arena here, and probably online as well. I'm not really active in Senators Twitter. So, you know, I don't doubt there are some differences from place to place, but Vancouver has a remarkably forgiving fan base. If you look at how easy folks are to please, like look at Boudreaux comes in. The season is effectively lost, but they win a few games in a row. And you would think that this team just vaulted to the top of its division, right? Like
people
are so anxious to cheer for something.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you sort of, the two you're talking about, sort of the Vancouver fan base. I mean, I know I will go and say I'm a Twitter OG. I feel that I am. I mean, I grew up in Canucks social media. It's how I actually got connected to the team and their social department was that I was helping moderate live blogs that they used to run before Twitter took off. And I would often say, hey, even, you know, taking part in this live blog, why not join a conversation using hashtag Canucks on Twitter? And that's how I actually connected and grew sort of my sphere of influence. But the Vancouver Canucks embraced that so soon on in the process that I think they helped foster this community that is probably more mature in the sense of age. I will admit there is divisive immaturity, but that is, I think, applicable to any fan base. Mm-hmm. But that sort of, you know, connected nature of sort of the market being the Pacific Northwest, the fact that you have a very sort of quote unquote mature operation around engaging and social. And one of the things that, you know, I think back to, and sorry, you know, you were talking about how, you know, Betting on Empty and the podcast sort of grew up in this creative era. I grew up in the Canucks blogger era, you know, the basement bloggers living in our parents' basement. I still lived at home when I started sort of, you know, working and collaborating with Canucks Hockey Blog. That's how long ago this was. Mm-hmm. And the Vancouver Canucks, albeit sort of looked at bloggers, well, I mean, quite a bit differently than maybe they look at sort of quote unquote podcasters and new media today. There was a significant sort of base that existed, and we started to see that, you know, mainstream sort of trickle in. I remember, Jason Botchford, who is well known, and I have to applaud you for number 103 in Benny and I did a tribute to Botch. I remember the first time I met him was actually at a Vancouver Canucks practice, and you could tell he was trying to avoid the bloggers, but he was curious and he asked questions and what have you. Well, I don't know a media member who totally embraced Twitter and sort of the Canucks meta, whether it be Schaap or you know, Canucks Army better than him. And that helped sort of legitimize that space. And I feel that allowed that sort of crossover from mainstream and newstream is what then cleared the opening for the creative era to even happen.
Yeah.
Like I feel that, you know, I'm not suggesting that I had any part in this. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. I have the best mediocre Canucks podcast that I enjoy, you know, recording. But the point is that there's so much more out there, including the comic, which I have been a follower from day one. Like I remember the first two had come out. I was kicking JJ around saying we should see about trying to CHB this. This is what my take was. We should find something and CHB it, bring it under the Canucks Hockey Blog banner. JJ, by that point, had sort of decided to move on from sort of the blog side. But, you know, talking about the comic, like I hearing you describe how, you know, there were those around the league who paid attention to it is, I'll be honest, pretty cool. Now, whether or not they loved it or hated it matters very little to me. I mean, probably differently to you, the author and creator. But the fact that it had been embraced within the NHL sort of sphere is pretty darn cool.
Well, the craziest part of it too was the reasoning behind it, which if anyone caught either of the two Botchford appearances I mentioned, he explains that essentially they seemed too close to the truth based on, I don't know, I think he made a point to say it wasn't people within the Canucks organization. So It would either have to be former members or perhaps people who dealt with the same individuals. I'm guessing mostly John Weisbrot, if we're being honest, but within other organizations. And he claimed that there were just elements of those conversations that rang a little bit too true to be random. Mm-hmm. And I did not work for the Canucks. I've never worked in professional sports. I was just, you know, largely satirizing what we were all reading. And to an extent, I guess, reading between the lines, like, you know, if the truth is often said in jest, like if you can see who I sort of portrayed as the villains and the innocent bystanders, like pretty transparently. And that is a sincere belief that I'm guessing based on, you know, the various roles that everyone had in the organization, who really would have been driving the bus off the cliff and who wasn't. And so I'm guessing that means I kind of got that aspect right. I've heard a few things that I'm not going to share on the record that confirm that to a certain extent, I guess, which is very cool. But yeah, the idea that it was accurate enough to be seen as leaked information was, I feel that's a feather in my cap.
A little frightening as well.
Very frightening.
But well, it's definitely impressive.
Out of curiosity, like, did you ever have anyone slide into the DMs and say, hey, you should create a comic on this who could potentially be somewhat in the know? Like, did that ever occur?
Yes. Not really high-placed individuals, but people who were affiliated with teams, yes. And nothing like hardcore, like, okay, here's what happened in a meeting and I'm sending you my notes. Nothing at all like that. But definitely a few people who pitched ideas. And a little, sometimes some tidbits of information to get a storyline going.
Cool. Yeah, no, I mean, again, I'm not talking about me sliding your DM saying, hey, I'm, you know, I think, again, I don't know, again, I look at it as sort of some validity to what our sort of collective experience as Canucks fans happen to be, and the ability to live vicariously through the comic that you were putting together. Like every new edition, it was an instant read. Like I needed to check it out. And I will admit that I became almost dependent for a while. Like if you were, there's no strip this week. It's kind of, you know, it's like that expectation. Like I opened up the Sunday paper, I expect the comics, right?
Like, it's funny you should say that, because I felt like I was letting people down when I wasn't able to cobble one together. I mean, it was therapeutic for me too, right? I enjoyed making them. Because it was kind of fun. Part of it was a way to sort of vent frustration, but part of it was also just a way to stay engaged, right? There was no real point in watching the games. I'm also on Eastern time, so even though I famously align with Thomas Drantz that late games are better because I have children who I'd rather be in bed when the game starts, I still wasn't watching them religiously by any stretch. You know, they had no meaning. That's also the fault of North American sports. If we had something like promotion and relegation to care about, that would be kind of nice to actually keep the season interesting. So, yeah, I mean, why else would I pay attention if not with the hopes. It's kind of like following a soap opera or, you know, a long running series. It's like you may actually at some point just grow tired of it, but you're so invested that, well, now you have to know what's going to happen, right? You know, you need resolution to whatever the storylines you're following are. So this was a reason to kind of stay engaged, and making it was just frankly fun. It started taking a little bit too long to do, because the very early ones I kind of purposely didn't put a lot of effort into. I was going for the webcomic look, like if you know, like Dinosaur Comics, which is like clip art that repeats from panel to panel. I was actually consciously trying to do that, but then as it went on, I started putting more effort into both the artwork and consistency, like actually, like, you know, making the characters wear the same clothes throughout or what have you. And it was starting to take up a lot of my time, and I was hoping the era would end, and I more or less retired it when the COVID pandemic hit, because for a while there were no games, but even when they came back, it wasn't, you know, there was only so many more storylines to do without simply just becoming like a current events comic. And so I more or less threw in the towel, and I said, okay, Jim Benning has won. He has outlasted me, because I never saw it going as long as it did. And then when things started going really downhill more recently, I kind of unretired it. And you know, when the writing was on the wall, I wanted to be there for that, you might say. And so I made sure to get one or two in at the end.
Yeah.
So, you know, go ahead, Anna.
I was just going to ask, because I think it's so true what Chris said, that like the coping mechanism thing, because every time something bad happened, that'd be like the initial stab of pain. But then it was like, first of all, what's Botch going to make of this in the provies? And then it was like, what's Betting an Empty Spin going to be on this? So like, I definitely think that was part of the reaction of the fan base. I'm wondering if there was one in particular that got like a reaction you weren't expecting, or like that people just like went wild for and you weren't necessarily expecting it to go that way.
So I guess the one Chris mentioned, I did when Botch passed, which was, you know, it was traumatic for everybody. The market still hasn't recovered. And, you know, in addition to the immense personal loss for his family, you know, for those of us who only know him in his professional life, it really shaped the coverage in the market, and including the way the team related to everyone, right? Like a significant voice was lost. And so it was a shock. I discussed this a little bit in the commentary for the issue that I did after that. But I didn't want to say, oh, this is an event, I have to get a comic out because a tragedy's happened. Like, that is obviously very crass. And I wasn't sure about doing anything at all. But I wanted, you know, I tweeted a little bit about, you know, like so many of us had an online relationship with Botchford. So I talked a little bit about that, you know, right when it happened, in the midst of everyone kind of expressing their shock. But then I said, well, the truth is Botch actually really liked my comic, and he encouraged me to do it. And I thought it'd be kind of fitting, actually. Like, you know, the medium is jovial, and it may seem a bit inappropriate, but I said, I want to put something out that's not supposed to be funny, even though I did have like a couple, you know, half jokes in the lead up to the payoff. But I dedicated half of that one to an image of Jason Botchford passing a torch to the new generation of media. And I issued it, and I didn't know if people just say like, oh, that's nice, or if people would say like, what are you doing? Like, your comic is like mean-spirited, and, you know, this isn't the time. But no, the reaction to it was overwhelmingly positive. It was the single most liked and retweeted issue of the series. And a lot of people like told me they were tearing up reading it. To be honest, I know I'm the one who made it, but when I was putting these all together for the book, I actually was tearing up a little bit making it as well. It was a rough time. And I don't know, it ended up being more therapeutic than I guess I thought it would be, I guess for other people too.
You know, I guess, you know, you sort of, to segue, you talked about putting together the book and sort of, you know, reliving the experience in some respect, obviously with Botch's passing, but I would imagine through much of the era. But I'm curious, what gave you the idea that, hey, you know what, maybe I can put together a compendium to, like, it's bittersweet for me. Benning on Empty, I feel is done. I mean, I really don't want there to be a fill in the next GM on Empty. Let's be honest. But like, what sort of, you know, motivated you to, hey, let's put this book together, get it out there? Because for me, I mean, it is, you know, one of the I have yet to purchase it. That's on me. I will though, because it's something I'd like to have. It's almost a memento of an era, good, better, and different, one that I can at least look back and laugh about.
Yeah, I first started thinking about doing something like that, probably at what in hindsight was the halfway point, which at the time probably seemed like the twilight days of the Jim Benning era, where I thought, like, you know, I put a lot of time into this and people seem to enjoy them. And so if anyone did want a collection, obviously all the strips are available online. I have a Tumblr account for them that I think is still in my Twitter bio if anyone wants to just have the full archive. And then I have a designated Twitter account for the strips as well. But so I always thought, well, people might enjoy having just the full collection in one place, and then I would add some value to it as well. And so I don't remember if I first floated the idea or if others actually came to me asking me if I would do it, but a few times I heard there was interest. So once the series went on long enough, that there were, you know, like more strips that, you know, for the first, I don't know, quarter of them, I could actually like remember just the order and the names of every issue, but that fell by the wayside soon because this just dragged on. And so, you know, I find myself going back thinking, like, oh yeah, that happened. And it's kind of just a nice record of, you know, I dropped it toward the end. So actually a lot of the drama is missed, right? A lot of the bubble season, for example, with like anything to Foley related and all the craziness that went on there and Holtby and all that is not really reflected in the strip. But for a lot of the stuff, including little things, I thought it might just be fun to have a chronicle of that. And so I, right when, I think it was the week that Benning was dismissed, I put out a Twitter poll saying, if I turn this into a coffee table book, would there be interest? And I want to put this out there too. I don't make money off of this. This is really just for fun. I incurred some expenses to make it happen actually, because it's just a self-publishing site. So if people buy the ebook version, I make a few bucks off of that, which helps me recoup those costs. But it's not supposed to be a business venture of any sort. I just, you know, it's kind of a pride project at this point. But there was a lot of, I mean, we're not talking thousands, but about 100 people responded saying that they would be interested in a copy. So I thought it would be worthwhile enough. And when work slowed down a little bit over the winter break just now, I downloaded the blurb software. I put it all together pretty quickly. And it was really a bit of an exercise in recalling everything that was in all of the strips, because there's a lot of what sort of amount to inside jokes to, I guess, Canucks Twitter or to people who are like really online. And some of them are not necessarily going to be all that evident to people who are not really in the thick of things. So I thought, oh, I should sort of take a tally of what I was actually talking about here. And a few times I had to recall if this was actually something that was being reported or whether I just thought it was kind of a funny idea. And I'll admit there's even one or two that I don't fully remember what, if that was the case or not. Most things, if they're not like obviously absurd, came from something or at least or an oblique allusion to something. But yeah, I just thought it'd be kind of nice to jot down some notes about, you know, what went into the comics, whether that it was actually forming them, like sort of the background material. I'm like, oh, this is what I was thinking at the time, or those details like, oh, you know, in case no one remembers what the hell I was talking about here, this is, you know, whatever happened that, you know, sometimes didn't turn out to be a big deal, right? A good example is one of my earliest trips was about the controversial loss of Frankie Corrado and the way they went about doing it, right? And it was like kind of
a big deal to me.
Well, it was one of those litmus tests, I guess, for like which side of the fence you're on. Is like, is it important to do things in a rational way or not? And so I had a whole strip about that, and I spoofed it saying that the reason why it happened is because they accidentally ended up on the French language menu of the LTIR phone, you know, tree, and couldn't get out of it. And, you know, so, you know, people may look back and say, who was Frank Corrado? Or like, that might not be something that's super obvious in retrospect.
Oh, you just swore it, Anna. You don't know the hell that you have unleashed.
Okay, insane people don't remember him? Especially as he's now, you know, an analyst for the WHL, doing some good things. So.
Yeah.
But I think the fact, it's so telling that you said that you can't fully remember sometimes if it's a spoof that you came up with or a real thing that happened.
Yeah, there was, you know, if not for the fact there were tweet evidence of it, I don't think anyone 20 years from now is going to believe that Jim Benning talked about getting more involved on the medical side, right? Like, that seems more parody than real. And, like, I don't know, stuff like that had to be documented.
The Jim Benning era. Was it spoof or was it real?
Yeah.
Only you can tell. Yeah. No. If any of our listeners are looking for the book, I will link to it directly in our show notes. But you can go to blurb.ca. You can search for Benning on Empty. You'll find copies there, hardcover, softcover. And then you had said there's an ebook option as well. And I believe you have all those links pinned.
Yeah. And just in case any of your listeners actually bought the ebook in the first few days I put it up, there was a coding error and it got a bit messed up. So I had to reissue it. Please let me know. Send me a DM or whatever on Twitter and I will replace it for you.
But, you know, this is great. We do want to talk a little bit about what's going on with the current era. Obviously, as I had said earlier, we don't want to fill in the blank on Empty, whether it be, you know, I mean, Rutherford, although he is Poho and there is going to be a GM and there could be a GM soon because we now have a new AGM. But you're listening to the C4 Canucks Hockey Podcast brought to you by the CanucksHockeyBlog.com and the Full Press Coverage Network.
Take hitting out of the game. You can't hit anymore, so don't do it.
The unsportsmanlike conduct, I want to get an explanation on that.
No kidding.
Because how do you get suspended for unsportsmanlike conduct?
Plus interference. There's no interference there. He had the puck.
Now, Madison never ever did that before. Now, why did he do it? Is that because he was mad?
Well, your early favorite for the Calder Trophy, that's for sure. Elias Pettersson, you might even say your early favorite for the Hart Trophy.
Just to get back to your question, Elias is going to play plenty. He's going to play. He's going to get a lot of power play time. And yeah, I'm concerned about our offense. We lost 200-point players, and we've got to find a way to score.
So let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Vancouver right now. I know you had mentioned a little harder for you to watch the Vancouver Canucks, especially when earlier this season when, let's be honest, I lived out west and I wasn't watching the Vancouver Canucks, so I can't imagine what it'd be like living out east. But the Vancouver Canucks did put on a good string of games before COVID went through the team and somewhat through the league. The thing is, the pandemic is still impacting the team quite well. If you happen to be a goaltender, you might be able to get signed to a amateur or professional tryout at this point. The Vancouver Canucks are that thin in the crease with, like, I think, was it Halak still in the States, I think, because of, like,
yeah,
the federal quarantine regulations?
So I think otherwise, if he had gotten sick in Canada, he'd already be off the books, off the protocol list, but...
But yeah. It is getting dire for the Vancouver Canucks. I mean, Spencer Martin gets his first start with the NHL team, acquits himself quite well, only to then test positive the subsequent day. Mikey DiPietro got put in the net. I thought Mikey did really well. The Vancouver Canucks did their best in front of a arguably better St. Louis Blues team and ran up against a goaltender in St. Louis that's currently on a heater. but you know, I keep reminding myself, and this is where, you know, back to the point you'd raised earlier, King, the Canucks started winning under Bruce Boudreau and suddenly it's like, whoa, man, we're back. Like my desire for there to be so much success and have this expectation that this is all we're going to see comes racing back. I forgave all trespasses. Even though really I should have been looking at this as, hey, this is pretty cool. It may not amount to everything, so temper your expectations there, Chris. But I'm still like, I'm really okay with what I'm seeing, despite the Vancouver Canucks going through challenges as in turn now racking up more losses than wins.
The other thing, it's good to be optimistic. Like, I think that's totally okay.
The C4 Canucks playoffs podcast.
It is. But you've got to be realistic, right? It's totally fine to be like, we're playing better. Like, we had played one of the best teams in the league with a goalie who hadn't played in the NHL in 5 years and Spencer Martin.
What are you talking about? Stanley Cup ring holder. I don't know. Is he a Stanley Cup winner? I guess he is if he has a ring, right?
No, it counts. But like, we got to a shootout. Like, we were the better team against the Blues for like at least two periods on Sunday night. Like, that's a decent achievement. You just have to set your expectations on these moral victories, on actual victories, and they started the year so badly that they don't really have the time to
It's good for everybody's mental health to see them win a few games, but you know, let's not get carried away here, right? It's at some point it may do more harm than good, which I know is a really cynical way to go about it, but you know, once again, that's the system they set up in North American pro sports, where unless you win the championship, it's technically better to be bad, unless you're really on the ascendancy. And both with a new management team and draft position, it's not necessarily in their interest to win too much.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's not only more important the way they play and respond to adversity. I think that's the only thing that's important than getting actual points, because we are so far back. I mean, it's hard to tell with all the different number of games played, but
yeah, I'm still stuck on this, that I continue to find myself, this is the 2011 team. They're back, baby.
I can assure you they're not.
Yeah, that was the best team in the league.
I know that. But like, I think
they have Burrows. That's,
they do have, they do, that's right. Have a Burrows. Yeah. A feisty Burrows. You know,
yeah, I think it was, things were that dire that really everything else is like sunshine and rainbows. And I'm not the most optimistic fan like you. I was down on sort of Benning from the get-go. I even started listening to some of the earlier episodes and I was like, okay, I'm not entirely sure this is the way to go, but okay. like I was like the benefit of the doubt. Sure. Maybe this is good drafting acumen. But oh my goodness. I do regret some of the things I said about the end of the Gillis era. Knowing what I know now,
how good we had it.
Oh man, I took everything for granted. But when I look at the Vancouver Canucks now, and I see this energized team, and not only that, and I mean, let's talk a little bit about what they've been doing off the ice. I mean, today, let me rephrase. Not just today. Yesterday, it was yesterday, maybe the day before. Rachel Dory got hired in analytics. And then today, the Vancouver Canucks hired Emily Castonguay as an AGM. I didn't catch her presser, so it may have come out then, but I presume she is taking on she's like the capologist, yes, contract negotiating role. Yeah.
Strength. Obviously, they were kind of careful not to put too fine a point on her position, but well, like, that's her background.
Now a former player agent, but well-educated lawyer. I mean, it's like the check box is there, that this is what you would as a fan like to see in the role. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's checking them all off. And I feel that the Vancouver Canucks, and I don't know if this is coming from ownership or it's Jim Rutherford saying, hey, I'm going to go and put together a good team and we're going to go and try to do something different as opposed to copy. That's, I think, what is maybe making me most optimistic.
Yeah, it's a bit surprising because Jim Rutherford is every bit a member of the old boys club as Jim Benning was. And he paid a bit of lip service in his opening press conference to, you know, being open-minded and thinking outside the box a bit. And, you know, that can be a cliche, so you never really know what that means. And it's interesting, especially before hiring a GM, to see him laying groundwork like this. I wouldn't have expected it, certainly. And, you know, today's news was particularly shocking because you'd always be worried, right? I'm a huge fan of Rachel Dory from, you know, the work that I know. And you would almost think there was so much debate over, oh, well, she's such a non-traditional hire that, you know, some people thought maybe, oh, well, this is what he was talking about. He was the non-traditional hire. Rachel Dory is a first-class analytics pro, right? You know, the fact that she's a woman or young or whatever is very secondary. I didn't see her as the example of like, oh, it's a new direction hockey-wise, but in terms of, you know, diversity of background, all that, like, I think she's like extremely who I want to see join my organization if I'm training for this team. So it hadn't necessarily occurred to me that someone like that would be this is the quote unquote diversity hire. But I thought the team maybe would say that, aha, we've done it. Now we can go back and, you know, hire whoever we want. So I was very impressed to see that didn't end it right there. Like, I don't know that much about Emily Castonguay, but she seems incredible based on what we've seen so far. It's great. Like, it's so nice to be optimistic again, right? It's just, you know, not just because she looks different from her predecessors, but she's obviously very intelligent. I like the agent background too, right? We have a good experience with that in Vancouver, and it'll be, you know, AGM is one of those black box roles, right? The old joke is no one knew what John Weisbrod did, mm-hmm. even though he's actually probably one of the more transparent ones. We actually knew a little bit too much what he did. So who really knows, right? If it's the Chris Gere role or what, but it's great to have brains joining the team and someone who's really worked her way up well.
On that note, and Chris Gere did come out and describe, I believe, I don't know if it was on a conversation.
It was. And
was it on Connect? Okay. Cause I wasn't sure if it was either on their 650 show or on the podcast.
I think 650 but he did would say be that, polite to ask.
Okay. Well, I mean, but Quaz asked the question and Chris Geard answered, no, he had a job. He had a number of people reporting into him.
It was vague. I'm not going to lie. The answer was pretty vague. I don't think it necessarily dispelled all the myths.
He scouted himself instead of doing managerial stuff and just had everybody reporting to him to feel powerful is what it sounded like. And well, I think that jives with what we did imagine.
Well, the thing that stuck to me was Chris saying like, oh no, he was, you know, Jim's sounding board. And I'm like, okay,
oh, yeah, there we go.
Like, you reinforced what I think all of us already knew and understood to be a problem. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, just to reiterate what you're saying, Yaki, like, I think both those hires are really promising. Obviously, there's a tiny cynical voice in the back of my head that's saying, like, this is a glass shelf. Like, the idea of, like, setting up these new, like, people that are new to hockey. Like, well, Rachel Dory isn't. Like, she's worked in the league side of things before. Like, but just setting up these sort of new ideas people, I guess I would put them as. But I do think, one, the fan base are too intelligent to fall for that. Like, they won't, like, go along with going back to some old school ideas. But two, I'm choosing to believe that Jim Rutherford, whether he's, like, doing it because he knows the way success lies or he truly believes in mm-hmm. analytics and...
Maybe it's a social experiment, right? But if it leads to the right result, that's good.
That's the thing. I'm kind of going with that. Like, I think he wants to keep his job, and I think they're finally in tune with a market that is just sick of an old way of doing things and the meat and potatoes hockey and signing old vets who are character guys in the room. And
they've learned they don't know better than this market. And there's no reason to think that they would know better than the crowdsourcing of literally millions of intelligent, well, maybe hundreds of thousands of intelligent people. And it's good to see them, even if they do think that they're pandering or they think they're throwing a bone. Like I say, if that, you know, ends up with the right result, that's such good news. And on the diversity side too, I want to throw in, you know, notice too that I don't think the Canucks have ever had a high-level Francophone member of management either. That's actually, I'm saying this is someone out in Ottawa, I'm bilingual myself, and it's actually pretty interesting to see. And I just remember when Alain Vigneault was around in the coaching role, he would field questions, right, from Radio-Canada, for example. It puts the Canucks more on the map, as silly as it sounds, of national media. I think it's kind of nice.
No, it's definitely refreshing, especially as, like, Vancouver market in general has such a that's not just a hockey thing, like, has such a bad reputation for accommodating or including sort of the Francophone side of things in the culture. Like, I remember when I moved here, this is off the rails a little bit, but I was started doing my friend's, like, university French homework from my, like, high school French that I hadn't done in 3 years. And I was like, this is pretty easy, guys. Like, how is this university level?
I know that feeling all too well. As a British Columbia educated guy who can speak French, there are times where I roll my eyes at my co-provincialists.
No, just thinking about the Franco, like, I think Mark Crawford,
he's from Cornwall.
well, no, but I think he could if need be. But Alain Vigneault is the one that would come to memory. And I was actually just sort of thinking back, like, you're right. I think we've seen a Francophone speaking member, which is actually quite odd because of the number of, you know, Francophone speaking executives we've seen in the NHL, how for some reason or another, one did not find their way at least to Vancouver. But
yeah, Chris Gere, I should point out, is from Quebec. He's from the Eastern Townships, which is like an English pocket within Quebec. I'm sure his French is decent, but he's not classically Francophone. Yeah.
But I think, you know, going back to sort of the Rachel Dorey hiring, there were some who were quite upset that she had been critical of the Vancouver Canucks, and there was this big hubbub over her scrubbing her Twitter account, which, first of all, I can assure you, if I got a job with the Vancouver Canucks, you'll know that I got hired. Why? Or really an NHL team. My Twitter account will disappear because you can't understand the number of stupid things that I've said that I didn't even know were stupid.
That's par for the course, right? Ryan Leafs did the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
I kind of love that she's still tweeting about, like, NFL and stuff like that in a very, like, fan way. And I was just like, good, you're sharing some, like, she still has her, like, personality through that.
But with the Rachel Dorey part, what I can't remember who it was that pointed it out. It might have been Sir Knuckles, but where people were upset that she had been critical about the Vancouver Canucks. And you got to think at this point, if the Vancouver Canucks were hiring people who are like, yeah, this Jim Benning era is bang on, this is a bigger problem because...
Well, yeah, I tweeted something to the effect of I'd be really like hesitant to hire anyone who wasn't trashing the team over the last 7.5 years, right?
Especially that's a huge selling point. Someone who did it so eloquently, the quote making the rounds about making macaroni art was just top notch.
Wasn't it? Was it Montreal? I'm trying to think. Was it Montreal? No, it was Detroit, I think, wasn't it?
Like, comparing it.
With the team was they're playing like 3D chess or playing
5D chess while Jim Benning is gluing pieces of macaroni to construction paper. Well said, Rachel.
There's nothing wrong with gluing macaroni to construction paper. My daughter has made some fabulous artwork, let me tell you.
Yeah.
But no, again, I think this sort of builds back as we sort of were talking about this and some optimism. The Vancouver Canucks during really the Gillis era had started to sort of push the envelope. Which, when you think back, like, I mean, Gillis was the furthest a team had really pushed an envelope in a long time. Not everything had worked out, but I feel that now we're seeing more teams willing to do so. I mean, we just have to look across the border into Seattle and see how they're trying to reestablish a different culture around the sport. And while I think it may be harder for a team like Vancouver to do, consider me pleasantly surprised that, you know, Jim Rutherford, who's grown up in the hockey circles as long as the next guy, has seemingly either one taken orders from ownership to do so, or is, and this is the part that I wonder, is he that intelligent of a hockey mind to know that there is a crack in the dam and we're going to see this start to happen soon? So why not get in today before the floodgates open? Because you got to consider, if we, let's say, wait a season or two, are Emily or Rachel even available? Or have they been hired up by other teams, right? Like,
this is the point
when you got to get that talent.
I think we got lucky as is. I think both Rachel and Emily had a few different offers and definitely would have had their pick if they waited around. So, yeah, I think we got lucky here. So,
I was... When rumors came out, I suppose, last year when ownership was really digging in and, you know, covering their ears and saying, la, 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 we're not making any changes, there were rumors of Rachel Dorey, you know, being part of a group that, you know, maybe had approached the team at some point. And it felt like such a missed opportunity because here we were, you know, stuck in the Stone Age with our own management and thinking how close we could have been to a progressive management group, it hit doubly hard, right? And so I absolutely agree. This is like, I don't know, finding money in your pocket that we were able to basically, what amounts to signing a big free agent, right? Because I absolutely agree that there's no way she was not in demand.
Yeah.
Both of them.
I think that, you know, is what's key. I mean, will this work out? Will the hires all work out? I don't know. But I feel that the Vancouver Canucks have figured things out ahead of other teams and are going to be able to grow from the experience. But, you know, Emily had, I think, said it quite well. It's about building a culture where people want to be here. She didn't actually say specifically just players, that people want to be part of Vancouver, want to come to Vancouver. And I can't say I've heard that from any NHL circles for a long time. Oh, yeah.
And it's nice to hear too, like, you can kind of apply it to the fans as well, like making the fans feel more positive about the team. Like, I mean, Botch said it best, I can't wait for it to go the other way.
This is, you know, if you're to tie it back to kind of the foibles of the Benning era, this is where if the last management group were just kind of classically bad as opposed to kind of legendarily bad, it would be a little bit easier because you talk about not knowing how big a difference these hires can make. We're not really going to know for a few years, right? Because it's going to be all cleanup for the next little while. Too much of the future was compromised to arrive at where we are now, which is, you know, basically a playoff bubble team with some very big locked in contracts and not a lot coming in the pipeline. So these are very intelligent hires. They're not miracle workers. And so unfortunately, you know, there's going to be so much maintenance that has to be done before we could even see the execution of a vision. And, you know, not to say that the team is necessarily terrible in its present state. It's just, it's going to take so much more than that if it's going to contend. And, you know, in most situations, you have a manager bumbling around for a couple of years, not having instant success, and then that person gets fired and you move on to the next group. And that's kind of what happened with Gillis and Nonis to a large extent. Now, unfortunately, there was a little bit too much forward damage done by the last group, I think, to really start with a clean slate. And that is a shame because, you know, they are putting together a nice team, and it depends partly on who the GM ultimately is, but it's, you know, they have their work cut out. There's no doubt about that.
Well, you know, speaking of the forward damage, I mean, really, you know, we, Anna and I have joked that we're the C4 Canucks playoffs podcast because looking at what the previous regime did going into this season, it was playoffs, baby, yeah. Because there wasn't a future beyond that. And I think you're right. It's going to take some time to get out from underneath some of those deals. However, there are rumors of deals to be had. Case in point, JT Miller apparently is a desired commodity. And I think it was today where it came out, there is some thought that it is a first round pick plus. So, Yerky, do you take that deal?
Well, it depends what the plus is, I suppose. But yeah, I would lean toward taking almost any deal that improves the quantity of good pieces in the future, because the margins are too tight in a capped league. Like, even if this team sneaks into the playoffs, and even if they fluke their way into winning a round, which is basically what happened in 2020 in very unusual circumstances, there is a point where the randomness runs out, right? It's not so random that it's a total flip of the coin or roll of the dice. And if it were, we should not be following this league, because that makes us stupid, right? If we're basically cheering for a random number generator. So there is more of an art to it than that. And I don't see how they can take a next step without quantity and quality, because right now that's not coming from anywhere. You know, the best case scenario is Podkolzin turns into a dynamite winger, and an unexpected prospect maybe really overachieves. And that's a very rare thing already, right? You know, the Alex Burrows story is by no means typical, right? You can't count on something like that.
What are you talking about?
So you have to wonder, where is it coming from? And you're going to have to give up real value to multiply the number of potentially valuable pieces you have. It may not work is the danger. And this is why I'm saying, you know, this management group is not going to be able to just walk into anything, because unfortunately, there's too many eggs in the basket that the Canucks are carrying right now. And so the easy thing to do is just to dig in and say, we're never going to have a better core than we do, right? The capital N nice young core with a little trademark symbol after it that all bad teams become after drafting high long enough. The Canucks are not unique in that position of having a nice young core, and it's not going to be enough. So what they really do need to is multiply the number of difference makers that they could have. And for me, for a guy like Miller especially, who, one, is a little bit older than some of those other pieces, two, is American, and I'm saying this as a half American myself, but this is a reality. It is much harder to retain those players. And three, is a player who does not give off the vibe of being really excited to take a discount to help retool this team. He seems obvious, and that's not a slam dunk that they turn that into good pieces, right? That's always the counter argument. Well, you know, you're just going to get a mid first rounder back and some prospect that may not pan out. Yeah, but that's the position they're in now. That's, you kind of have to, you know, if we're talking about banking on hope, you're actually, you have to do that more going forward than just kind of hoping the current core makes it, because they're probably not going to, right? The numbers don't support that. And they're not horrible, and they're not as horrible as they seemed in the first part of the season, but they, you know, they don't have the defense core especially, and they that has to come from somewhere. So I would be in favor of not just Miller, but probably other pieces too, whether that's Besser or even Horvat. It's, I mean, sorry, but that's where we're at.
I mean, I think there are those of us that were critical of the Miller trade when it happened, not because it wasn't of like good value, but because it was maybe the wrong time to jump on it.
And it was.
And yeah, I mean, the Canucks tried to dunk on us on national TV about it, but it was the wrong time.
Jackson McDonald specifically, yes. Yeah.
But it was funny. Like, I was definitely of the opinion, we've got him now. Let's push and see where this can go. He should be, like, he was untradeable for, like, the first part of his tenure with the Canucks because we've made this bet. Let's see where it goes. As we kind of figured, like, we were fell short. Like, he's a really good player.
Yeah, but like, was he going to win that team a Stanley Cup? No. And like, if that's, you know, if that's quote unquote all that matters, and I always push back against that philosophy, but as long as that's what we're operating by, then why, you know, why would you do that other than you're trying to get two games of playoff revenue? And so the timing was wrong. That, you know, that point of view has been vindicated, I think, at this point. Mm-hmm. And this is the dilemma that we find ourselves in now. And I mean, the nice thing is, you know, I'll give them credit. They targeted a good player and one that was better than a lot of people realized, whether that was through skill or luck, I don't know. But, you know, so look at the bright side. You've made a really strong investment here. Sell it and, you know, maximize your return.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm of the mindset at this point, the Vancouver Canucks, if they can turn players into picks, that's what they need to do. If they can get contracts off the books, that's what they need to do. Like, they have to figure out a way, not to necessarily expedite the rebuild, but to find a way to get to the rebuild.
And just, like, right? Have, like, some first round picks. We haven't had a first round pick in a couple of years. Like,
I was going to say, the team out in Ottawa there, yes, they've got their own troubles, but the one thing that they went and did is they're like, well, yeah, we're not entirely sure how these picks will pan out, but if we have a metric ton of them, we're playing the odds. Yeah. And I, you know, whereas the Vancouver Canucks were like, we don't need them because we're going to, like, we're a playoff contender. I mean, we've talked about that on this show. The bubble was probably the worst thing that happened to the Vancouver Canucks.
I mean,
because it's like the 2 years, what happened in 2 years, it showed up early. It's like, oh, we're there. We don't need two more years.
And it was obvious at the time too, right? Like, there was no, that team was falling fast when the pandemic hit and ended up being kind of saved by it. They were not, you know, they were okay. They were playing a COVID-ridden St. Louis Blues team that was the defending champions who wanted to get the hell out of the Edmonton bubble. Like, these are not typical conditions, right?
Once again, like, much like we're seeing the Habs this year, who kind of excelled in, like, interesting circumstances, I don't think anyone really, like, when he thought about it, thought that St. Louis Blues were, like, going to be an era-defining dynasty team. Like,
oh yeah, they were, if anything, they're that example that all the bad GMs keep pointing to, is that what might happen, right?
Exactly. That's, I mean, we talked about that as, like, the bubble and the fact that the Blues won the cup after being dead last in January was just so damaging to the Canucks.
Yeah.
I was going to say, there's a fair number in Canucks Twitter that also point to the Blues.
Right, because it's what you're hoping for. It's, and to be fair, right, it's a 32 team league, right? Like, the Vancouver franchise really missed their big opportunity to be good in the, like, 80s and 90s before the playing field got leveled through the salary cap and analytics and all this, because that was when you actually could just be better than everyone else. That's where you had to rack up your glory days, because now, again, the margins are too tight. It's a 32-team league. In any given moment, chances are your team is going to come nowhere close to winning, and that is true for all 32 teams, except for one or two at a very fleeting moment in time. And so you have to cling to these little bits of hope, right? Like, hey, maybe we can be the Blues, but it's not a game plan. It's a prayer is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think goalies were, like, the just game plan for maybe, like, 3 or 4 years, just have an elite goaltending and then the rest will figure out itself.
It's also why reading into playoff series is like, as telling you what team you have, is that's a fool's errand to begin with. And that is honestly a sickness in North American sports fans, that they'll look at, like, an 80 game sample size and be like, nah. And then, you know, your team wins 4 out of 7 games. And, like, that is the team that gets celebrated for ages. Like,
yeah.
I mean, that's stupid.
I've had this argument, like, so many times with, like, friends from back home where they're just like, so you're the team you support, like, with the best team in the league for 2 seasons running, like, finished top of the league. And it doesn't matter. Yeah, that is correct.
It's incredibly stupid. Europe has it right. In fact, the whole world has it right, other than North American. And I think maybe Australia too.
Yeah, I mean, the Premier League, by the way, no, like, healthy like way to be doing things, but yeah.
That's for different reasons. But yeah. Wouldn't it be nice, for example, to have both distinctions be meaningful, to acknowledge that the season-long champion probably did something that's harder to do than win a couple playoff rounds, and also win some hardware on the side in a nice side cup competition? Then we have lots of things to cheer for.
I was going to say, the Vancouver Canucks did win some hardware those two seasons.
Yeah.
But the North American mentality is that hardware matters absolutely.
Yeah.
Won't even touch it.
You did nothing.
Yeah. It's. I know that's a sidetrack. This is a long-standing pet peeve of mine.
Yeah. I feel like
it's a coworker of mine who from the UK happened to be in Vancouver in 2011, knows a little bit about hockey because of that. Trying to explain to her how that season is essentially equivalent to the subsequent season where the Vancouver Canucks get bounced early. Like they're one and the same, right? Like one game for all the marbles and get bounced early. Same thing.
Yep. Sorry, Ham Hughes got injured. Your season doesn't count.
Yeah, exactly. But none of that's going to change as far as the game is concerned. And as is our segment within a segment, we are looking at a game changer ourselves. And Anna, you're up. You got a game changer in mind.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really hoped to not be talking about this again after our segment last week on, like, PEI hockey. But, yeah, my game-changer proposition, which I've kind of had for a while, but it's kind of been brought to a head, is there are no theme nights allowed without corresponding social action. And why this has been brought up, because within the 2 weeks of Willie O'Ree's jersey retirement, both the AHL and ECHL have had headline racist incidents. So I guess what I'm saying is it's all well and good celebrating Willie O'Ree and what he did for the game, but like if you think him succeeding in the league changed hockey culture, like it's 2022 and it didn't.
Yeah. I think, you know, when I was reading this, I'll admit there's some conflict because I completely agree. But then I also look at Willie O'Ree and say, this is someone who deserved the recognition well before this. Right. And I know you're not trying to correlate the two. I think, you know, my issue and the one that I share with you here is that the league and really hockey culture and so on is still very performative. Yeah. Oh yeah. Look, we celebrate diversity because we have a game on it.
Yeah. I mean, pride, like, all the pride nights that go on and yeah.
Right? Like it's, yeah. There is so much more room, and yeah, come here. Was it Ken Johnson? I can't remember the reporter today that came to the defense of the player in the E as to his career being canceled. And I, you know, okay, you know what? Maybe it's not that fair, but I'm more of the opinion that if you make a gesture that can be like, it's not a stretch to interpret it as potentially racist. Like it's not like, I'm just misunderstood as the player is trying to portray. And maybe that truly is. I would much rather err on the fact that that does not belong. I can suggest it does. It is racist because it's not a stretch.
Also, I mean, if you're talking about the same thing, I'm thinking of Ken Campbell's article on Hockey Unfiltered, where it was basically equating cancel culture with systemic racism. Which to me is bonkers. I would just love some people with privilege in this sport to be, not just doubting people of color's experience of everything they've had to experience throughout the game. I would love some white players to start talking about this.
I genuinely, you know, and it's like last week's episode, right? I genuinely wonder why it's so difficult. I understand it's ingrained within the culture of the sport. It's not like flip a switch and hey, it's better now. But why is it so difficult to actually commit to the change, right? Like the league itself with the NHL, they have performative nights. You know, and the Vancouver Canucks, for instance, they have performative nights. And there are times when I genuinely wonder if they're truly committed. They may be, right? And I'm not trying to suggest they are not in this particular case, but what more could they do to make that change, right? We were talking about this during the offseason about Seattle, how Seattle is really looking to embrace change. And here is why we're doing it, and putting the right people into the position to allow for them to have a much louder voice. Maybe that's what the Vancouver Canucks are starting to do. I don't know, but I think there are more teams that can do that. Like it should not be this hard.
Yeah.
And I, you know, whether it's race, whether it's the rampant misogyny within the sport.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, I think you just
this past weekend,
getting the other voices in the room is really important.
Yeah. Like, Jurki, I saw a conversation you engaged with on Twitter where with the, I don't know if it was Rachel or with Emily, where someone had come down like, oh, why are they hiring a woman? And, you know, like the comment was like, someone had tried to say it shouldn't be hired by, you know, genitalia, which was, they were trying to suggest it was, and like the, you had talked about, yeah, because there has to be this, you know, rigorous inspection, totally didn't happen. I'm like, well, no, the Canucks have done that. Like Tommy Larshide was in the room and he checked out Pavel Bure's groin and it was okay. It felt okay. But not to make light of this, but for me, it's like, you know what, maybe like I then sort of thinking, I'm like, what does it matter? Maybe the Vancouver Canucks do make this pledge. This is what we're doing. It's the, like within the league, within the sport, there has been such an advantage given to me for, I mean, you know, I'm straight, I'm Caucasian, I'm male, right? Like it and you might not, you know, people might say, oh, Chris, there's no advantage given. There has been, it's systemic. The system has been set up to allow for someone like me to succeed where others do not. You can't simply say, okay, we're fair and balanced now, and we're just going to let the merits define that. There needs to be a balancing before the merits can actually be applied, truly, in my opinion. And I, again, I'm getting on a soapbox that I don't myself fully understand. I just know that change is needed.
Now, what if the theme night's like bobblehead? What a company is that?
They can just give out the bobblehead. I'll allow that. But yeah, it's funny that it's like you'll see like the list of theme nights in... like Canucks have gotten in trouble for this in the past, and I know it's because they kind of want to do it right when they do it, so it's not always fair. But like, you know, when you're seeing Star Wars nights, and then it's just like, oh, they like a team doesn't have a Pride night, but they have a Star Wars night, you know, stuff like that. Just think, yeah. Like, I mean, fair enough, like it's goofy, sports is fun, but there's just like so many people that are excluded from the fun, to put it mildly, right now. So,
but I'm genuinely curious what you, our listeners, think about this issue, anything we've talked about. You can obviously reach out to us through Twitter. We're at the C4 Podcast on Twitter. We have Discord, discord.io/ReadySetPwn. We're there. You can also drop a message or text to the C4 text line. That number is 604-200-6201. 604-200-6201. And this week, we do have a text message from a friend of the show, Lisa Martin, who simply tells us, my offer stands for next year for beverages. I am hoping to get up to Canada this summer if it is safe to travel. Miss BC and the lovely Canucks fans. And Lisa, I know this offer, you continue to pledge. We've been talking about beverages now for years at some point. I don't know if they'll happen in Seattle, though, because like... I think you have to take a bank loan to get like a couple of beverages down there. Like what are beverage prices out to your way, Jurki? Like,
So I did attend a game this year. I attended the final road game of the, or was it the second last? Was Montreal before or after? Maybe it was the second last of the Jim Benning era though. And so I want to say like a tall boy of beer will set you back about $12, I think.
Slightly cheaper.
Yeah,
that's better. That's better than what it would be.
It's not the same market. There's not a lot of variety at the Canadian Tire Center in terms of amenities. I haven't been to, I was about to call it GM Place because I haven't been there once since it was not GM Place any longer. And I remember it being pretty impressive in terms of what's there. So I imagine there's a wider range, but yeah, it's not cheap, but there's not as much corporate support out here and there's not as many people. So I think the offerings are maybe a little bit more pedestrian.
Well, it's still, I mean, price-wise, I mean, that price is better than what we would have here, and it's better than, like, the $24 US down in Seattle.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when, was it Rob that I want to say tweeted out the picture of, like, the prices when he was walking around the Climate Pledge, and it's like, say what? I mean, Seattle's expensive, but my goodness, I can't imagine having to pay that for a beverage. But Lisa, thanks for dropping that text message. And again, be like Lisa, let us know who you are when you do drop that text, especially that initial one, because it just makes it a whole lot easier. Otherwise, Anna and I have to guess, and we're gonna guess wrong.
Yeah, we don't want to offend people. So yeah, just sign your text. Make like your parents. Like, I don't know if anyone else's parents do this, but my dad signs every single text. Love, Dad. Even though I definitely have his number. But make like that.
You never know. But Yerky, thanks for hanging out with Anna and I tonight. I know it's pretty late for you. I had said we're probably going to get this under an hour, and I lied. I have a habit of doing that.
You have to take it off with my wife, but it's all good. This has been fun, and I'm glad to have an opportunity to chat about these things with you guys. And you know, this is the times are really changing here as Canuck fans, and so it's always interesting to kind of try and get a pulse on where people at, because it's probably a bit more fractured and variegated than maybe it had been back when we had a cold war of sorts going on with two defined camps in the fan base. So it's interesting to see what's next for all of us.
But if you're looking for Yerky on Twitter, it's at Yerky21. Benny on Empty is at Benny on Empty. And you can find the Benny on Empty Tumblr at bennyonempty.tumblr.com. Yeah. The links to the ebook, the hardcover, softcover, I'm going to include them in the show notes. You can find them as pinned tweets, both on, I think, Yerky's account and on Benny on Empty on Twitter. But if you've not seen the comic strip, if for some reason, I don't know if you as a Canucks fan could have missed them, but if you have, because maybe there are some new Canucks fans, check them out. They're... Oh man, they're a good reminder of some very dark times. As a student of history, you got to remember the past so you don't repeat those same mistakes in the future. But thanks for joining
us. Thank you, guys.
But Anna, any final words of wisdom for anyone this week?
Well, I have to agree with Yaki that some of the best content on Canucks Twitter kind of came out of the pain. So I kind of hope that we've been scarred and we will retain that creativity as we go into maybe different times, and that we're still funny even when we don't have to experience some process pain. So I guess we'll see.
Words of wisdom for me: get vaccinated, get boosted, and continue to be safe. Don't be like Chris or a Vancouver Canucks goaltender, because I mean, we're all one and the same. I can't see it any other way. But if for some reason you do get befallen by COVID, please be well and do what you can to get healthy, including keeping others healthy around you. But on behalf of Anna, A4603, myself, Chris at Lightforce, and our special guest, Yerky at Yerky21, I'm going to sign this episode off with We Out.